Hi, Greg Perry, the Historic Preservationist. Welcome to Season 3, Episode 96. So we're going to be talking about one of our founding fathers tonight, Jefferson, but in a really unlikely way. Something dealing with his astuteness of the beauty around him. So let's talk about Jefferson, the patron of the arts. Edmund Randolph, the Virginia statesman, wrote of the youthful Jefferson, "He panted after the fine arts, and discovered a taste in them that not easily satisfied with such scanty means as existed in a colony." He added, "It constituted a part of Mr. Jefferson's pride to run before the times in which he lived. No words could more aptly describe him. From early youth, he displayed a passionate interest in the fine arts, particularly in music, his first and most lasting love. His interest embraced also painting, sculpture, and architecture, and even gardening. When only 21, he purchased James's Theory and Practice of Gardening, the first book on the fine arts we know that he owned. And the following year, in 1765, he acquired Stenson's works on Dodsley's famous description of the Lissonniers. The book was to have great influence on Jefferson's development and the design of Monticello, which is far in advance of anything yet existing in the New World. Very early in the life, Jefferson also bought books such as Palladio's works and Morris's Select Architecture, and before 1771 he likewise owned Webb's Essay on Painting, and Spence's Polymetis, a handsome book of engravings of classical subjects, which he did much to form Jefferson's taste over the balance of his lifetime. By 1767, Jefferson was already at work on plans for the development of his mountaintop and the house he proposed to build there. We have the elaborate notes he made for the embellishments of the grounds, with grottos, waterfalls, pools, and even statuary, all in the romantic mood still new to America. Dreams for his new house likewise occupied him. It was to outshine anything he had ever seen yet. While it was building, he made an imposing list, which included copies of statues and paintings he had known from other books. Among them were the Venus of Medici's, Florence, Hercules of Rome, Apollo of Rome, Dancing Fauns, The Rape of the Sabines. These early ideas, which represent the aspirations of a very young man, were destined not to be realized. Before it was possible to set about carrying them out into effect, Jefferson became deeply involved in the revolutionary movement. All his thoughts and efforts were centered on that, so the art tended to take a back seat. A hiatus of some years ensued. In 1784, Jefferson went to Europe to minister to France, and in his real education in art may be said to have commenced at this time. He still cherished the idea of acquiring copies of famous paintings of the great masters. Indeed, he never entirely gave it up, but it ultimately became subordinate, and he grew content to acquire certain other paintings by minor masters, as his interest tended to shift. This ambition of Jefferson, which would today be regarded with contempt, was entirely in harmony with the taste of that time. The walls of the finest houses and many palaces were hung from floor to ceiling with copies of famous works rather than originals. Just how fully Jefferson succeeded in realizing this ideal, we do not know. From a list of his paintings sold at the time of his death, however, we learn that he had bought copies, at least, of Raphael's Holy Family, Leonardo's St. John, Van Dyck's Dissident from the Cross and Crucifixion, as well as Rubens from his Lantern. Soon after his arrival in Paris, Jefferson began haunting the auction rooms and buying pictures and sculpture, at first rather casually. Thus, in October 1784, he notes in his pocket account book that he had paid for two pictures of heads. From the provincial, whose wistful note of countries whose improvements in science, in arts, and in civilization, it has been my fortune to admire at a distance but never see, Jefferson was not long in becoming one of the society's greatest literary of the first order. The artistic and liberal world of literary was his first order, and he learned this in Paris shortly and shortly repaired to the hotel of the American minister of the Champs-Élysées. He was on terms of intimacy with the Comte de Zanier, the director general of Battements du Roi, battements or buildings of the king, who had a collection of the most precious things Jefferson and friends had ever seen. Jefferson, the Count, Richard and Maria Cosway formed an inseparable group. He also knew most intimately, as he tells us, that amazing man, Baron Grimm, the pleasantest and most conversable member of the diplomatic corps. He was the oracle of that society, there's no doubt, and as such as the Empress Christine's private correspondent and factor, in all things but not diplomatic. Inevitably, such persons and the circles dominated by them stimulated Jefferson's interest in the arts and influenced his critical judgment. It was at this period that a definite plan for forming a collection, for collecting, as opposed to buying pictures and sculpture, so much just as household furniture, seems to have developed in Jefferson's mind as a real passion by this time. This was to assemble portraits and busts of the most distinguished contemporaries and his friends. The first step in this direction had been taken at a meeting of the Cincinnati in Philadelphia in May 1784, when Jefferson, who was on his way to Boston to embark for Europe, commissioned Joseph Wright to do a portrait of Washington for him. He said, "I could only allow Wright time to finish the head and face and sketch the outlines of his body." He tells us these and the drapery were afterwards finished in Paris by Trumbull. A further impetus to the idea came through Jefferson's association with Houdin. The state of Virginia wanted a statue of Washington to adorn the new capital, and Jefferson was entrusted with obtaining the figure as well as the plans for the building. He turned to a leading sculptor of the day, Jean-Antoine Houdin, then at the zenith of his fame, and in May of 1785, he visited Houdin's studio for the first time. Not only was Houdin persuaded to make the long voyage to America, perilous in the eyes of a French artist, to take the figure of General Washington, but Jefferson became such an admirer of the man whose chisel seemed quite destined to consecrate the immortality of a illustrious man in every walk of life, that he gradually acquired seven of Houdin's portrait busts, the famous head of Voltaire, the Turgot and Lafayette, Franklin, Washington, and John Paul Jones. The last was a gift from Jones. In the Salon of 1789 appeared a bust in plaster by Houdin, labeled M. Sasserin. It was, of course, at once recognized as the likeness of the American minister, whose tall figure was familiar in the streets of Paris. On his return to America, Jefferson carried with him, so far as we know, three copies of his work. When Jefferson arrived in the French capital, controversy was still ablaze over Houdin's Diane, the famous undraped figure of the goddess of the chase, which had been refused by the Salon of 1781 as being overly sexual. That Jefferson admired in this figure was no doubt. So on July 14th, he paid for seeing Houdin's Diana in bronze. £3. It seems probable that he toyed with the idea of buying it. Among his updated papers in a notation, Houdin's Diana in plaster he bought for 25 guineas. The equally famous La Frise could be had for 15 guineas. Inspired by the success of the revolutionary ideas in America, the sculptor Cerici came to this country in 1790 full of plans for a gigantic monument to freedom. He likewise wanted to do an equestrian figure of Washington in bronze, possibly in Valley Forge. Jefferson was consulted on both matters. Congress, however, turned a deaf ear to those schemes and returned to Europe within 2 years. While here, he made the bust of Washington, Franklin, Jefferson, and Hamilton. On March 27, 1793, he wrote Jefferson from Munich that he expected to go to Leghorn and have the pleasure to cut your bust in marble and present it to you as the pattern of my chisel and a little mark of my esteem. A year later, the bust was finished and dispatched, along with a well-executed piece in alabaster as large as life of my friend Mr. Madison. It was not long, however, before Cerici thought better of his generosity, and Jefferson was pelted with bills for the bust. Although under no obligation to do so, on January 14, 1800, he finally sent an order for a 550 Dole patent for a marble bust of myself by Cerici. This bust was placed on one side of the entrance door at Monticello, Cerici's Hamilton on the other side. Opposed in death as in life, Jefferson was found of saying. Eventually, it went to the Library of Congress, where it was destroyed in the fire of 1851. A plaster replica is still preserved in Monticello. To supplement his sculptor, Jefferson sent out to acquire canvases of the man with whom he had worked on forming the United States. The first of the men to whom he had worked was Adams. So when in London in 1786, Jefferson, who had been taken into the circle of the West Copley and Turnbill, had sat for a portrait into the circle for the first time, so far as we know. It was executed by a young American, Mather Brown, a conspicuous member of the group, and Jefferson paid £10 for it, feeling perhaps that this picture combined quality and price, as like the rest of the world, I like to have a good thing at a good small cost, he wrote back to Trumbull on October 22nd of 1786. Will you undertake to prevail on Mr. Adams to set on his picture and on to Mr. Brown to draw it for me? I wish to add to it those of other principal American characters, which I have or shall have, and I would rather like to have copies of to put in Monticello. Trumbull, who was to paint the most sensitive of all these likenesses of Jefferson in his signing of the Declaration of Independence, reported on March 16th of 1788, Brown is busy with the pictures. Mr. Adams is like, you know, yours. I do not think so well of. This worried Jefferson, and he wrote back asking whether his were a copy or was an original, because he agreed that the original should be mine, and it was what I paid for. But meanwhile, in October of 1787, Jefferson had commissioned Brown to do a third portrait of him, that of Thomas Paine, the celebrated author of Common Sense, who was staying in London at the time. This was dutifully executed, and along with one of Adams, hung in Monticello until the time of Jefferson's death. Before leaving Paris, though, Jefferson added one more to his already burgeoning gallery of American portraits. This was a thoughtful and dignified likeness of Benjamin Franklin, an original drawn by Abel Very, as his catalogue tells us, in 1701. In April of 1790, after his return to America, Jefferson wrote William Short, his secretary, "My pictures of Americans will be absolutely incomplete without of Lafayette." De Short was given the task of selecting a painter and of inducing it to the Marquis himself to sit. Although Lafayette complained that he had not even been a moment's spare of silence and relaxation, by November the portrait was finished and a bill for 486 livres was presented by the artist, Joseph Boos. The Paris days had been busy ones, and in other respects also. In October 17th of 1787, Jefferson had written Philip Mazarin, whom he is known in America and who he has sat with time and time again in Italy for portraitures. In London, Trumbull had meanwhile been set at work on another problem, to have copies made of what Jefferson called his Trinity, Bacon, Locke, and Newton. March 15th of 1789, Trumbull wrote from London, "I have made inquiries about the pictures to which you inquire of me. A young man who I know and who will do the copies as well as the most copyist undertakes to do them for 3 guineas each." So isn't it interesting how the original masters producing paintings, engravings, and sculptures had a whole series of junior artists under them ready to do these copies for just a mere pittance of the original. It's absolutely amazing. But anyway, back. "I do not think tolerable copies can be secured for less. The bust in plaster of Newton, Locke, Bacon, and Shakespeare may be had for 23 guineas or 30 each, and this is the size of life, actually." 10 days later, Jefferson instructed Trumbull to have the portraits copied. These and other portraits thus prevented Monticello from looking too much like a hall of just casts. Jefferson started to make a catalogue of his paintings and sculptures, but it was never finished. It lists some 58 canvases, but certain pictures which were hanging in Monticello at the time of Jefferson's death are not even mentioned. Many, if not most, of the subjects were of religious nature, but they were varied by a few landscape or even on canvas. After having run the risk of transportation from London to Florence to Paris to Philadelphia to Washington, and lastly, most importantly, difficult to Virginia, as he wrote, Jefferson's collection was finally installed at Monticello. This was not entirely complete, though. However, until after his retirement from the presidency in 1808, vital, as were his interests in the arts, and advanced, as were his views, he was unable to detach himself from the ideal of the 18th-century collector, who mingled the curiosity of natural history with works of art. Thus a rather unusual display greeted the visitor at Monticello, therefore. The entrance hall was treated as a museum and contained rare and unique things, according to the Baron de Martizan, who visited Jefferson in the September of 1816. There was the upper jaw of a mammoth found in Kentucky, an Indian painting on a buffalo skin, tusk and teeth of a mammoth and an elephant, the head of enormous sheep and rams on the walls, the antlers of a huge moose and the heads of many other animals, 2 busts in stone sculpted by the savages, one representing a man, the other a woman. They are very hideous and coarsely carved. And my question is, how do these blend in with these wonderful paintings and sculptures? The hall also contained, among other things, the Shiraki bust of Jefferson and Hamilton, as well as Houdin's Voltaire and Turgot. Also views of Monticello, Mount Vernon, the Natural Bridge, and other places. A sketch of Trumbull's large picture, The Surrender at Yorktown. a drawing by West presented by Kusuko, and a reclining figure of Ardeline in marble. The drawing room opened off the hall, and on either side of the opposite door, on brackets were placed Cerici's bust of Napoleon and one of Alexander, Emperor of Russia, presented to Jefferson in 1804 by Levette Harris. This room was used very much as a portrait gallery. Here, says George Ticknor, who came to Monticello in 1814, are the best pictures in his collection. Over the fireplace is the Laughing and Weeping Philosophers, dividing the world between them. On the right, the earliest navigators to America. Further around, Mr. Madison in the plain, Quaker-like dress of his youth, Lafayette in his revolutionary uniform, and Franklin in the dress in which we always see him. There were other pictures and a copy of Raphael's Transfiguration. The American worthies of Locke, Bacon, and Newton were also represented there. The dining room, beyond this, the tea room, which were the center of family life at Monticello, housed and remained important objects of his collection also. Raphael's Holy Family and Benjamin West, Hector, and Alexander hung in the latter. The two rooms were further adorned with the noble busts of Voltaire, Lafayette, John Paul Jones, Dr. Franklin, and Washington, supported on brackets fastened to the walls. Although very likely he never thought of it as much in terms, Jefferson had thus taken his place among the most enlightened and most treasured band of men, the patrons of the living artist. In doing so, he allied himself with the great princes of the past, with which the most far-seeing men who were to come after him. Greg Perry, the historic preservationist, signing out. Thanks for listening.